The Cycling Podcast, in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee shops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport.
Where are we, Lionel? Daniel?
We're going to try and confuse people straight away. We are, I'm Daniel, not Lionel, and we're in Palma, Mallorca. What the hell are you doing here?
I find myself here in the centre of Palma with you, Daniel, on a family holiday, actually. I've broken off from my family to join you for a bit of podcasting. We are a man down, unfortunately. Lionel was going to join us.
Couldn't make it to Mallorca, could he?
He couldn't make it. He's unwell.
Probably a bit too warm for Lionel already. It's about 16 degrees, 13 in the shade.
Oh, he'd be uncomfortable. Yeah, he's unwell. Nothing serious, don't worry. Just a cold, I think, sniffling. I'm a bit under the weather myself as well, but I'm braving it.
I saw some quotes the other day from Nathan Haas of Katusha Alpecin about pro riders nowadays almost constantly, or a lot of them constantly, being subpar as far as their health is concerned, overtrained. I think the same applies to podcasters, doesn't it?
It does. And interesting you should say that, Daniel, because we have an interview in this week's episode, and that sets up very nicely with Jeroen Swart, who's a new head of medicine or medical director at Team UAE Emirates, and he talks about that very subject, about riders being constantly overtrained, overraced, and in a state of fatigue.
Also, Rich, is a bit of a postscript to our discussion a few weeks ago about Strava Noia, which went viral. Well, it certainly made the press in Belgium. Strava Noia, we came up with this term to describe the feeling of sort of anxiety and insecurity that grips pro riders, but not just pro riders, amateurs as well, when they think that, based on other people's Strava, they're not training enough. I understand that Laurens ten Dam talks about this in his podcast, rival podcast, but it's okay because it's in Dutch, this week, and he said that he's pretty appalled by some of the amount of training that some of his younger colleagues are doing, and he thinks they'll all be overtrained by April. It's a bit of a theme this year, isn't it? And Mark Cavendish hinted at it in our interview last week, that they're talking about the younger generation and how dedicated they are to training and how sort of focused they are on numbers and data and watts and so forth. And some of the older guys are feeling a little bit sort of off the back.
And Nathan Haas is below par himself, isn't he? He's had some health issues the last couple of years, and apparently is again sort of been sent away for further investigations, examinations, before he resumes his season for Katusha Alpecin. But He went out to Tour of Oman and hasn't finished. He's come home. So that's a shame for him, because he looked a couple of years ago to be on the verge of some big results. And he was obviously signed by Katusha Alpecin with that in mind. Shall I crack on with the news roundup, Daniel?
You don't have to ask, Rich.
Well, it's Lionel's been good enough to send from his sick bed some notes for the news roundup. So any factual inaccuracies here are entirely down to Lionel. Shall we do a free-flowing jazz news roundup again?
Let's give it a go.
Well, there's quite a lot to pack in. I mean, a huge week for Astana, first of all. 8 wins in 6 days. If that's incorrect, it's Lionel's fault. That's between the 15th and 18th of February, by 5 different riders in 4 different countries: Colombia, France, Spain, and Oman. In Colombia, and we'll talk about this a little bit, there was the very snappily named Tour Colombia 2.1. What do we think about that?
The race or the name?
The name.
It's not the most imaginative or the snappiest, is it?
No, but it was some race, and it was won by Astana's Miguel Angel Lopez. The top 6 overall were all Colombian: Ivan Sosa, Dani Martinez, Egan Bernal, Nairo Quintana, Rigoberto Urán were all there. The first non-Colombian was Julian Alaphilippe in 7th, and he was a stage winner along with his teammates Ali Hodge and Bob Jungels. Juan Molano and Nairo Quintana won the other 2 stages. In Provence, where I saw Bernard Tapie made an appearance. Bernard Tapie, of course, ran the La Vie Claire team back in 1985 and 86, and Haven't seen him at a bike race for many years. There was a bit of a Lavie-Claire reunion, which was interesting, some old characters, but Jean-Francois Bernard was there. He was once Tappy's favourite son. They gave him a Ferrari, I think, when he won a stage of the Tour de France in 86. But Tappy's aged very quickly, it seems, very, very quickly. He has been unwell, and it was quite surreal to see Tappy's charisma still very much intact. I don't know if you did. You see that bit of footage, Daniel?
I didn't, but I followed the reports about his ill health over the last 2 or 3 years. I think he's been suffering some kind of cancer, hasn't he? Anyway, Rich, never mind Tappy. What's happened to Andrea Taffy's bid to ride Paris-Roubaix? We're lacking an update on that. Anything in Napalm's notes about that?
Nothing. I don't think it's going to happen, is it? It's not looking good. He has not, as we speak, got a ride with a team, it seems. So at 52 years old, his dream of one final Paris-Roubaix may be dead in the water. Bernard Tapie, as I said, was at Provence for the Tour de la Provence, which was won by Gorka Izagirre, one of Astana's new signings, after his brother Jan won in Valencia recently. It was very close overall, with only a second splitting the top three. Simon Clark and Tony Galopin were also on the podium. In Murcia, more Astana success at the Vuelta a Murcia, where Luis Leon Sanchez and Peyo Bilbao finished first and third and won both stages. Alejandro Valverde, the world champion, was second overall. In Oman, well, we're speaking just after the Green Mountain stage on Wednesday, which was won by Alexei Lutsenko. He also won stages 3 and 4, and he looks likely to win for the second year in succession when the race finishes on Thursday. Lutsenko is a bit like the sort of Simon Spilak of the Tour of Oman, isn't he? Spilak traditionally rides well in a couple of races in Switzerland, and this is the race that Lutsenko seems to enjoy most of all.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Rich. We talked a couple of weeks ago about Tim Wellens and how he has tended to target the very early season races, sort of acknowledging that that's probably his best chance of success in the season. And Lutsenko seems to be similar. But having said that, he's a rider who's been sort of bubbling under for a few years now. I saw him compared to Moreno Argentin by Roberto Damiani, the Cofidis Direct Sportif, which I thought was an interesting shout. I would say that Argentin was probably a bit punchier. Argentin, of course, won Liège Bastogne-Liège 3 times. Flèche Wallonne, I think, 4 times. So he was certainly the best Ardennes Classics rider of his generation. Lutsenko hasn't produced that kind of performance yet in the Ardennes, but he's someone to look out for in those races.
Maybe a similar build, quite stocky. But yeah, he's not. He was quite emotional when he won at Green Mountain. Said that his wife had a miscarriage at the end of last year and lost twins. That was very sad. But as I say, he's set to win the Tour of Oman for a second year in a row. Other stages won by Alexander Kristoff of UAE Team Emirates, continuing their good start to the season, and Sonny Colbrelli.
Stop press erratum. Moreno Argentin won Liège-Bastogne-Liège 4 times and Flèche Wallonne 3 times.
At the Trofeo La Guelia, I think I said that correctly, first time round, Daniel?
Yeah. Just call it the Trofeo Pippo Pozzato.
Well, it was
synonymous with the Peacock of San Diego, that race, of course. He won it 3 times, but alas, is now roller hockey player.
Well, it was won this time by Simone Velasco with a 42-kilometre break. His team, Nero Sottoli, missed out on a place at the Giro this year, but that was a phenomenal performance from him, and he was very emotional at the finish of that race. Did you see much of that, Daniel? What did you think of that?
Well, it was a bit of a shock. Like, Guelia is not the race that it used to be. The field isn't the strongest, but the Velasco's team, Neri Sottoli, are pretty aggrieved not to have received a wild card for the Giro, and it was a massive result for them. I saw people from that team talking about it's one of the best days in that team's history. That team, of course, has been had various different names in the past: Farnese Vini, Fantini Vini, but it's Luca Shinto's team. So yeah, big feather in their cap.
At the Clásica de Almería, which I watched, it finished in Roquetas de Mar, where Simon Clark won a stage of the 2018 Vuelta. You might remember that. It was a long-awaited win for Education First. But at the Clásica de Almería, Pascal Ackermann, the German champion, sprinter on Bora Hansgrohe. He won that. Well ridden by his team Bora Hansgrohe. They had quite a few guys at the finish to help him. He looked quite nervous. He kept fiddling with his shoes, tightening his Velcro straps and so on. And he won ahead of Marcel Kittel. Now, Kittel, I don't think there's anything wrong with Kittel physically, but he was badly positioned in a very small group of only about 25 riders. He managed somehow to lose his lead-out man, Marco Haller. What, it made me think of a joke, actually, Daniel. What do you call a lead-out man who's lost his sprinter?
Go on, Rich.
A man. Anyway, Marco Haller looked completely at sea as he was preparing to lead out Kittel, and Kittel was nowhere to be seen. Now, Kittel came from a long way back, and he looked strong, and he was certainly finishing a lot quicker than Ackermann, but Ackermann won. And Ackermann is a young German sprinter who's got a place in the Bora Hansgrohe team at the Giro this year, and there's probably quite a lot of pressure on him as well, because he's edged out Sam Bennett for that spot effectively, and that win will have done him no harm at all. But as I say, I don't think there's anything wrong with Kittel physically. That was just a case of bad positioning and bad judgment. Coming up in the next week, we've got the Ruta del Sol, the Tour of Algarve, Tour de Var, where Romain Bardet makes his seasonal debut, and the next World Tour race is the UAE Tour, which starts on Sunday. Some non-racing news. Well, we'll talk a little bit about this later on, but maybe a little update on the search for a new sponsor for Team Sky. A good news story, well, it's turned into a good news story. The junior edition of Paris-Roubaix's future was in some jeopardy because of a funding shortfall. John Degenkolb, the 2015 winner of Paris-Roubaix, launched a crowdfunding appeal to raise €10,000 to save the race. He donated a quarter of that amount himself, and the target was reached pretty easily. It now stands at €16,000 as I speak. Former winners of that race include Geraint Thomas, Guillaume Van Kiersbroek, Jasper Stuyven, and Tom Pidcock.
Yaroslav Popovic.
Yaroslav Popovic and Andrew Fenn, in fact, ahead of Peter Sagan several years ago. So that's great news, and I think reflects very well on Degenkolb that he put his money where his mouth is and helped save Junior Paris-Roubaix. More sadly, the RAS in Ireland, iconic stage race in Ireland, has been cancelled, also due to the lack of a title sponsor. Very sad news. It's been around for many, many years, and has had very many illustrious competitors in the RAS in Ireland, hasn't it, Daniel?
William Fotheringham?
Previous winners include Stephen Roach in 1979, and Tony Martin in 2007, and Lucas Postelberger in 2015. So very sad news about the RAS. Other news that I'm particularly interested in, Bart de Klerk of Wanty Group Gobert became the first professional to race with an artificial hip. Started at the Tour of Oman. He's 32 years old, and he had a year and a half out as he adjusted to his new hip, and he's back racing.
This is news close to your heart, isn't it, Rich?
It is, amazingly. These are all based on Lionel's notes.
Remarkable. Second mistake, second erratum of the podcast so far, not going too well. Napalm, SOS. Popovic did not win the junior Paris-Roubaix. He won the under-23 Paris-Roubaix.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsors, Rafa. Grateful to them as ever for their support. I'm just looking on the Rafa website there. Who's that modelling the new Pro Team bib shorts, Daniel?
Well, it's not Richard Moore. Mike Woods?
It is Mike Woods. They've obviously roped the Education First riders into modelling. One of our members of our team, Tom Wally, producer extraordinaire, and someone whose voice you will have heard on the Explore series of podcasts, he is actually at the Education First training camp as we speak, and in Girona, and we'll hear some interviews that he's doing there in the coming weeks.
Also a bit of a Mike Woods doppelganger, isn't he?
That's a good... He is. He does look like Mike Woods. That's a good point, yeah. That'll not come across I don't think, in the interviews. However, Daniel, we were going to just turn our attention a little bit to Colombia. A lot of people talking about the Tour Colombia 2.1, as it's known. I don't know how much of the race you were able to see, but it was extraordinary. There were extraordinary scenes, the crowds. The racing itself was almost, whenever I managed to see it, it was like a throwback to a different era. There was the stage that Julian Alaphilippe won in particular, I thought. It was, I don't know, it was like watching something from the 80s. There were guys just going at each other. There was no sort of, didn't look like there was any calculation, no conserving of energy. It was just attack after attack, very aggressive, thrilling to watch. And it looked like, I don't know, a cross between schoolboy racing and old school racing.
Yeah, absolutely, Rich. The racing itself was, as you say, a bit of a throwback. But, you know, I think part of that was due to, well, is due to the kind of atmosphere at that race. You know, it's no secret. Everyone will have seen that the crowds are incredible and have been incredible the first two editions of that race. But it's also a throwback in the sense that, you know, without wanting to patronise the Colombian sort of cycling public, it's a different demographic. It's still very much a popular sort of working class, lower middle class sport in Colombia, as it used to be in Italy and Spain, and you know, it makes for a completely different vibe, and it's a fantastic spectacle. And I think that the riders are inclined to come out of their shell in that environment. And of course, you've got this, well, fantastic generation of Colombian riders which has emerged. And you know, it reminds me a little bit of the Tour of California when that was in February, in just in the 3 or 4 years after its inception. It was very early in the season. People thought that the top riders wouldn't be at their best and that it might be a bit of an anticlimax. But I actually thought it was a better event back then because, you know, if you built it, they did come. As in, you put on a big, prestigious and well-supported race for the local riders or in their home regions, in their hometowns, and they can't help but get motivated and train and prepare for that race. And that's what we saw in Colombia. You know, guys that shouldn't really be peaking for 3 or 4 months. Very much, well, certainly competitive and in pretty decent form. You know, that it was the best riders in the field were the ones that came to the top. So the Superman Lopez's, Quintana, Bernal, and Ivan Sosa as well.
And it was great to hear the Colombian commentary you know, hear the sort of affection and esteem in which those guys are held, and how these nicknames are just thrown in there. Superman, it's never Lopez, it's always Superman Lopez.
And also Nairo Man. It seems almost unfair that you've got two superheroes competing against, you know, a field of mere mortals.
Nairo Man. I don't know, yeah, Nairo Man in his little cape. It's funny, last year was the first year that race attracted a sort of a big field and was held at this time of year. And already, you know, second edition, it's established, as it seems, it's got this momentum behind it now. You can imagine this is going to become a real fixture on the calendar.
Yeah, I mean, the president of the Colombian Cycling Federation said it's going to take 2 or 3 years for it to probably get all category status, and world tour status is sort of further away on the horizon. I think it's going to go up one day next year, so it's going to go from 6 days to 7 days. They're talking about moving regions as well, going to the Bogota region. This year it was very much based around, well, Medellin and Antioquia, so Rigoberto Urán's home region, where, well, the federation feel there's more support on a crowd level, but also on a political level for the race. So, you know, that's going to be interesting to see. But as you say, there's no doubt that, this is the big sort of new market. I'm sort of hesitate to say new market because cycling in Colombia, it's a marriage that goes back a long way. The bigger mystery to me is how is this sort of period in the 90s up until the millennium where, you know, the supply line was kind of cut off of top Colombian riders anyway. But, you know, it's definitely the most exciting sort of new market for for professional cycling as far as I'm concerned. It reminds me a little bit, you know, the last few years, usually on the back of someone winning the Tour de France, we've seen huge explosions of interest in certain countries. So, for example, in Denmark, we saw it when Bjarne Riis won the Tour in the mid-90s. Then we saw it with Germany and Jan Ullrich. And the next big one was the United Kingdom with Wiggins and Froome. And now there's no doubt that Colombia is the most exciting, intriguing, interesting force emerging in professional cycling, both as far as the riders are concerned and as far as the fans and support and interest is concerned.
I mean, you say the supply line was cut in the 90s, Daniel, but the cycling culture in Colombia is so deeply ingrained and so well established that you don't imagine there weren't talented young riders appearing in the 90s. A lot of people put that their disappearance at the top level down to EPO.
Yeah, I think that may well have been a factor. I mean, certainly people like Greg LeMond have espoused that theory in the past. I think there were also definitely issues on an organisational level. And you know, we saw this current generation sort of flourish relatively slowly at first, but there were sort of behind the scenes things happening with the Col de Portes team and you know, various people kind of manoeuvring and making it easier for young Colombian riders to come to Europe. And at the same time, I suppose, you know, the world has got smaller with things like with internet and the ease of access to, you know, the races that are happening there. People can watch them, and various different agents have got involved with the Colombian talent pools, and they've made the supply line of Colombian riders to Europe easier. And now, of course, you're going to get this fantastic emulation effect. I mean, I can't believe that there won't be an equally good generation in 10 years of guys who have grown up watching, you know, the Chavezes and the Quintanas and the Bernals.
And yet, remarkably, despite all these riders, a Colombian has still not won the Tour de France. And I noticed you put out a call out on Twitter today, Daniel. I think a year ago or so, you asked the people of Twitter to suggest who would be the first Colombian Tour de France winner. Who was it a year ago, who people thought, and who is it today?
Well, I think it was very close to poll between Superman and Nairo Man. So it's going to be some kind of superhero in a cape. But the consensus seems to be that those two still probably represent the best hopes, with the addition of Egan Bernal. I don't think Bernal was at his best at the Tour of Colombia this year. It's probably still a little bit undercooked, and indeed you could argue that there's a bit of confusion maybe in the Team Sky car on stage 5 whereby Sosa was down the road. Sosa Man was down the road, and Bernal Man Sky chased behind him, and Sosa ended up losing the race by 4 seconds, and that might have cost him his own team's tactics. But Bernal is definitely, well, he's definitely positioned himself in the last 12 months as the heir apparent, hasn't he? Having said that, Superman had the best year of any Colombian last year. He was on the podium twice in Grand Tours. He's going all out for the Giro this year. I don't know, Rich. I mean, I look back at the results from the Vuelta last year, and he lost a minute to Simon Yates, who's, you know, not the greatest time trialist. Well, he's a rider of relatively small stature and does pretty well in time trials, but is by no means a pure ruler. Superman lost a minute to Simon Yates over about 31 kilometres in the long time trial in the Vuelta last year, and he kind of frittered time as well in the first week. So, you know, there's a lot of work to do there. Can he find 2 minutes on a rider like Simon Yates? Can he find maybe 4 minutes on a rider like Tom Dumoulin, who's going to be up against in the Giro, particularly on a course which the better time trialists among the Grand Tour contenders have identified as being favourable to them?
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet there reminds me to tell you that this week's episode of the cycling podcast is sponsored by The Economist. Now, you, as a listener to Cycling Podcast, can get a free print copy of The Economist. I'll tell you about how to get that in a moment. But The Economist is the smart guide to the forces impacting your world. It's about far more than just economics and finance. It covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, arts, the environment, and even sport. It helps readers prepare for what is going on in the world around them. The Economist sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story in a time when facts matter more than ever. It's been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years, and it's for the kind of person who never stops asking questions and wants to know why the world is the way it is. Now, the article that caught my eye, and it's one close to your heart, Daniel, The Singer and the Song, and it's all about how poetry slams in the Basque country are helping to revitalize the Basque language, especially among young people. There are events called Bertzolaritza, the Basque oral tradition of improvised song. It's particularly popular, I said, among young people, where they stand up before a crowd up to 500 people have been attending these events, and they have to basically invent a poem of between 8 and 12 lines which fits a prescribed rhyming form. Very exciting and thrilling, apparently, and as I said, this is helping to revitalise the language. There were 2,000 such events last year, and what the statistic that really interested me and caught my eye, we know that the Basque Country is a proud place. It's got a great cycling tradition. We've covered it on the Cycling Podcast. But a study in 2016 showed that 34% of people in the Basque Country speak the language, Euskara. That's up from a quarter in 1991, and it includes 70% of Basques under the age of 25. Local languages, Daniel, I mean, we tend to think that the world is becoming homogenized and more people are obviously speaking English, and we're in Spain now where English is more and more kind of prominent. What's the picture like in terms of local, like Basque and other local languages in Spain in particular?
Well, Rich, I was with one of our colleagues, Pete Goading, photographer, the other day. He was here for the Challenge Mallorca, and he was getting in a bit of a flap because he said, I don't speak any Spanish. And I said, well, you don't need to speak Spanish in Mallorca because most people speak Mallorquí, which is a dialect of Catalan, but that is probably the most commonly spoken language in Mallorca. People speak Spanish as well, but it's always interesting when we go around, we travel around, particularly Italy and Spain, to observe the regional dialects and how much they're used and by whom in particular regions. You would think that regional dialects would be used more by old people and they're dying out. That's not necessarily the case. For example, if you go to the Veneto in northeast of Italy, there's been a kind of growing phenomenon of young people turning more and more to dialect in recent years. And yeah, as I say, it's very sort of disparate picture. In some places, there's no doubt dialects and regional languages are becoming less readily used, and in other places they're becoming more readily used.
Well, The Economist is a smart guide to the forces changing your world, so if you've never stopped asking questions, get your free copy now. Text 78070 with the word cycling. That's 78070 with the word cycling. Well, Daniel, as you said, we've talked in the last few weeks about teams that are attempting to reboot this year, having had disappointing years. Dimension Data, we heard from Mark Cavendish last week. We heard from Katusha Alpecin a couple of weeks ago. And another team certainly hoping to do a bit better this year is Team UAE Emirates. They've been Team UAE Emirates for a couple of years now, and I've sort of struggled to get results, frankly. Riders have underperformed there. Alexander Kristoff was quite a big signing last year, as was Fabio Aru, who really disappointed. Dan Martin sort of saved their season with a spirited performance at the Tour de France, if nothing else. And they have rung the changes over the winter. They've signed Fernando Gaviria, obviously. They won a stage in Colombia thanks to, well, Juan Sebastian Milano. You told me that it's Juan Sebastian Milano rather than Juan Milano.
Sebastian, and he refers to himself as Sebastian.
Sebastian. Well, you know, I'm going off Lionel's notes there, so it's Lionel's fault. However, He's another promising young rider, 24 years old. And they already look like a team this year, mainly thanks to Gaviria, who are at least going to win some races. But they've run quite a few changes in the backroom staff in particular.
Yeah, they have, Rich, and there have been changes that have taken place over a couple of years, really. You mentioned Molano there. I suspect that Machin Fernandez was very instrumental in his signing. Machin Fernandez, I think we featured him in a Giro podcast last year when we talked about scouting. And he's the man behind a lot of the success that Quickstep have had over the last couple of years or last few years with young riders. He was the first scout, given the name of a scout, in the World Tour at Quickstep for a couple of years. Then he moved to UAE to link up with Mauro Ginetti, whom he used to work with at Sornier de Val. So I imagine that people like Molano were definitely on his, have been on his radar for a while. There have been other changes in the sort of physiology, medical department. So they've got three new faces in that department, I think. So Inigo Samian, Jeroen Swart and Adrie van Diemen, formerly Greg LeMond's coach, formerly at Garmin. And it's all looking quite different. I mean, it's a team that, you know, I've spoken to various riders about over the last couple of years, and they've been fairly dismissive about the idea of joining that team, saying that it was basically the old Lamprey. All the staff was Italian, had a sort of traditional mentality, whether it be the doctors, the mechanics, the soigneurs. And slowly, there's been a sort of sweep of a new broom through that team. And I think the results are starting to materialise. They won about 13 races last year, not enough, as you say. Christoph looks as though he's coming to this year in good form. I noticed in Oman that he was at the front when it was a fairly select group, when the splits had taken place. So he looks as though he's in the right place at the right time of the year. Dan Martin is a guarantee, I would say. He's become a very consistent rider, always offers you something in the most important period of the season. And the big unknown, I would say, is Fabio Aru and how they get the best out of him. He had an absolute nightmare last year, and he wasn't much better in 2017. So I'm intrigued to see how they're going to tease the best out of him.
Well, you need a goal scorer, don't you? And Gaviria is a guy who should win races for them. And if they are winning races, an awful lot else might fall into place. They've got guys like Valerio Conti as well, who's always looked really talented, often makes mistakes, and he's not that young anymore. He looks capable of winning races, but if someone like Gaviria is notching up wins, it will take some of the pressure off some of the other guys, perhaps.
It's a really good roster that they've got now. I mean, they've also signed Sergio Henao. They have
Diego Ulissi,
another young rider who I suspect was picked up by Machin Fernandez, is Jasper Philipsen, who's already won a race this year. Tadej Pogačar, I think, the Slovenian, very highly rated young climber. So
I like how you look to me for pronunciation there, Daniel. I'm
no expert on Slovenian. But in terms of talent, they're right up there now with the very best. I also think in terms of budget, they're right up there with the richest teams in the world now, and they certainly have the ambition to be, if not the best team in the world, then close to it. So those guys need to perform, but as I say, everything's kind of looking a lot better than it was.
Well, I spoke to Jeroen Swart last week. He is a South African who will be familiar to some of you as a physiologist. Interestingly, he's the medical director at the team. He's not part of the coaching department, but he does have a lot of experience and expertise as a coach. He was also the scientist, or one of the scientists, in the lab when Chris Froome did his tests in London in 2015, wasn't it? 2015.
You were there, Rich.
Was it 15 or 16? Well, it was one of those 2 years. Anyway, you might remember that story. Froome had come under a lot of pressure to do VO2 tests and other tests in the lab. He did that, and Jeroen Swart was one of the people overseeing those. So we featured him on the podcast quite a lot around that time. And he's always an interesting voice on the subject of performance and also on anti-doping. because he's been heavily involved in anti-doping in South Africa. As he tells us here, his official involvement in anti-doping will have to end now that he's employed by a team. But his appointment really did catch my eye. I was fascinated to see him take that step and join a World Tour team, join the staff of a World Tour team, given his reputation and his expertise. So caught up with him last week in South Africa, and here's what he had to say. I mean, Jeroen, we know you well from your work with Chris Froome in the lab, but Ashley Moulman, Passio, and other athletes, and anti-doping as well. How did you come to be appointed head of medicine at UAE Emirates?
Yeah, well, it's actually, it goes back to about halfway through last year, when I got invited to do a keynote address at the Science of Cycling conference, which is a conference which happens just before the Tour de France every year. And after my keynote address, I was contacted by Inigo San Milan, who's a sports physician and a scientist who works at the University of Colorado in Denver. And he had been approached by the team to set up a new medical and new performance team for the coming season, which is the season we're in at the moment. And we've been following each other in scientific circles and, on social media, people get an awareness of, your attributes and your various other factors. And so he approached me and asked whether or not I'd be interested. And fast forward to where we are now, February 2019, and here we are.
It's a team that it's sort of evolved from the old Lamprey team, and it has had a very Italian culture and backroom team. Have you felt so far that they're open to your input and to really rebooting things, because they've also been underachieving, I think it's fair to say, the last couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, objectively, they didn't perform that well last year and the year before. I can't really speak to the reasons why that was the case, but there was a fairly extensive overhaul, and in line with that, there's also a new sponsor. So, I mean, UAE stepped into the fold a little earlier than was planned, but this is a country team. I mean, the team is effectively a national team with national sponsors, and it's a long-term project, so it has to have an international flavour as a result of that. But as you pointed out, it comes from historically a very Italian team, and obviously I had my reservations, and I think other people did as well, about whether or not non-Italian speaking individuals would be able to fit into the team from a cultural and from a language perspective, and whether or not there would be a very open culture. And in fact, I've been amazingly surprised and very pleasantly surprised about how open the existing members of the team and staff have been, and how welcoming they've been to all of the individuals that have joined the team. And in fact, it feels like a family, and everybody works together extremely cohesively. Everyone respects each other. So very, very surprising at how well that process has actually played out so far.
And you've worked a lot with athletes individually, coaching them one-to-one. Jeroen, what's it like being in a team environment and in a World Tour team environment? Have there been any surprises or anything that you've seen that you really feel needs to be addressed?
Yeah, the thing about working with an individual is when they approach you, that they want to work with you. So there's an immediate buy-in. They recognize your skills. They want what you have to offer. And when you come into a team environment, you always face the prospect of, the team may be inviting you to be part of it, but you need to actually have the riders buying in. And in any environment where you come in with 29 athletes, you always expect some resistance from some individuals. But so far, we've actually had very open acceptance of methodologies that they're not used to, that they've never used before, that they've never seen before, and to a greater extent, the riders have adopted all of these new protocols and scientific methods that we've introduced, and so far, I think we've had some great results. So, It's been pleasantly surprising from that perspective as well. And working within a team is, you know, in terms of that aspect, not ideal. But I think it's a challenge that I really felt was something I would like to be part of. And it's a long-term challenge. So we'll see where it leads us in the coming years.
And when we were speaking earlier, you mentioned two things that caught my attention. One was you've worked a bit already with Dan Martin, and he's posted a very strong time trial already this year. You also mentioned the fact that in your view, a lot of guys competing at that level are frequently overtrained, that can be a real issue for cyclists in particular.
Yeah, so my role is as the medical director, and the key aspect there is to look after the health and the well-being of the athletes. We've got a separate performance director who's Inigo San Milan, who I already mentioned, and his role is to look at all the performance aspects. But from my background in terms of my research and the skills that we said that I have from the services that we offer at our own Sports Science Institute in Newlands, Cape Town, the key areas where I've added value, I think, is in the biomechanics side, where we have a strong research background and individuals who really understand cycling biomechanics really well. And one aspect there is the time trial. And I think we've made some good gains in terms of the riders' positions on the time trial bikes, their ability to produce power and be comfortable and stable. We're doing quite a lot of work still where we hope to make some more gains. But as you point out, Dan had a very good time trial. I think possibly his best time trial, finishing 10th on what was essentially a flat time trial until the very end. The last 500 meters was uphill, and I know he was very happy with that time trial. So we've hoped to make some further gains there with wind tunnel testing and other aspects that we still need to do. And then the other aspect is, as you pointed out, is in terms of making sure that the athletes don't end up overtrained and ill. And I think the vast majority of World Tour cyclists are often in a chronic state of fatigue, where there's this feeling that you need to do these excessive training loads. And yes, you have to be prepared, but often they end up over-prepared. And then as the season progresses, we see a lot of riders progressively actually underperforming. And often that's as a result of doing too much training. And we've done a lot of research in our university and in our department. I did some collaborative research with Professor Robert Lamberts, who's originally from Groningen, but who is now a professor at Stellenbosch University, but who was with us for many years. And we developed some systems to actually assess fatigue and training status with a submaximal test. And those are things that types of things that we're implementing to, you know, keep track of the riders and ensure that they're not doing too much, that they're not excessively fatigued, and that they respond adequately to the training.
And obviously your reputation as well has been forged in the anti-doping field in South Africa. I guess that's a big part of your remit as well in the team. And is that one reason why they've brought you in to bring some of that influence to bear on the riders?
Not specifically to bring that influence to bear. We do have rigorous internal protocols that we follow. And unfortunately, you know, because of the conflict of interest that it presents, I'm not able to continue my work in anti-doping with regards to the sport of cycling. So I've had to give up that work where I worked for our own anti-doping organization, SAIDS, in South Africa, and for the Salt Lake City Lab in the US. So I've had to discontinue that work. And within the team, it's really making sure that you know, we educate the riders about the use of medication, to make sure that they know what's on the prohibited list, and we obviously monitor internally to make sure that if we see anything that we're not comfortable with, that we address that at an early stage.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science and Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. You can still get 25% off your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25. We don't have an expert's answer this week. Ben Samuels, our Science and Sport expert, has been otherwise detained, but we do have a a bit of a backlog of questions, but do keep them coming in. Contact at thecyclingpodcast.com to email, or alternatively, you can send us a voice memo to the number. This is a WhatsApp voice memo, and the number is +44 7971 338 205. That's +44 7971 338 205. Like I say, it's a voice memo rather than a phone call, if you don't mind. Thank you. And thanks very much again to Science in Sport. Now, Daniel, the other story that has been rumbling away has been, well, a two-pronged Sky story. One is whether Geraint Thomas will ride the Giro or not, and the other is whether Team Sky will have a new sponsor, whether they will continue into 2020. Reports last week were that Dave Brailsford was talking to people in Colombia. Gazzetta dello Sport, our friend Ciro Scognamiglio, reported that Ecopetrol were in the running to become the new title sponsor of Team Sky. That was perhaps premature. Certainly, there's a good relationship being established in Colombia, and they've obviously got a couple of very promising Colombian riders at Team Sky. But I think you were privy to some rumours last week that there may well be interest, serious interest from parties looking to take over Team Sky, and I've heard that now as well, that the future could be secured for Team Sky quite soon.
Yeah, the Colombian story, well, we talked last week, didn't we, about the why it might happen, why it might not happen. I think we both heard in the last week or so that, you know, obviously talks did take place. Sky went with a big delegation of staff and sort of top brass in the team organisation to Colombia, and that got a few sort of antenna buzzing. But Brailsford said at this stage it's unlikely, and I understand that it's certainly not. If there is a negotiation taking place, there's certainly talks with someone else, another party that are more advanced.
Yes, indeed, that's what we've heard. And I mentioned the Geraint Thomas story. I don't know if it's connected in some way to the fact that the team is in this uncertain phase, but it's certainly notable that for a decade Team Sky have had a lot of continuity in terms of their partners, people like Pinarello, who have been with them from the start. And this story has emerged of not discord, but a difference in the messages coming out of Team Sky and from Geraint Thomas himself and Pinarello, the bike supplier, that Geraint Thomas, they think, Pinarello think, that Geraint Thomas will ride the Tour de, ride the Giro d'Italia, and Geraint Thomas seems adamant that he will not ride the Giro.
Well, Richard, it's worth remembering, A, that Pinarello is an official partner of the Giro, and also that around about this time last year, we were talking a lot about Chris Froome and the Giro and why he was going to the Giro, and he mentioned, well, people were talking about the possibility that he'd received a fairly sizable sum of money, or that Sky had from RCS to ride the Giro. So you know, it's not inconceivable that RCS will have made Sky and or Geraint Thomas an offer, a financial offer, to ride the Giro. It looks to me as though Pinarello might have either got the wrong end of the stick, or he was trying to sort of entice Thomas into doing the Giro. I mean, their plans all along have been that Bernal would do the Giro as the leader. The course definitely suits Geraint Thomas. There's a lot of time trialing. There's also the issue of his cohabitation with Froome at the Tour. Can they pull that off in another edition of the Tour? They did it pretty well last year, but and also Froome, I think it's becoming fairly evident that Froome is a different animal this year. We talked a few weeks ago about how he's opened up about the toll that his salbutamol case took on him and his training, and the fact that he was distracted at the start of last year. And I think this year, well, he looks, in Colombia he lost over half an hour on one stage, but generally speaking he looks lean, he looks focused, and you know, that might make matters a bit more complicated with Thomas.
It would be a feather in the cap, wouldn't it, for the Giro to have the reigning Tour de France champion
Also, though, if we're talking about, you know, no one really knows this, even even La Gazzetta dello Sport, which is, to all intents and purposes, the owner of the Giro, they've never published any in-depth information about this. But we all kind of assume that there is this slush fund. There's a bit of a war chest that RCS use to entice the biggest stars. And, you know, that's possibly been Chris Froome in the past, Tom Dumoulin as well. If you look at the number of riders, the number of top stars who have put their hand up for the Giro, you imagine that it might already have been used up, whatever money is available for that kind of thing, because the field is looking pretty sparkling with, whether it be Simon Yates, Superman Lopez, Dumoulin, I'm forgetting.
Primoz Roglic. I mean, yeah, it's stacked, really, but there is this... I think the Giro almost senses that there's a moment in time as the Tour... I don't know, a lot of people seem to have turned off the Tour as a spectacle. Sky have made it a little bit formulaic and to some a little bit boring, and the Giro seems to have seized the moment in a certain respect, getting Chris Froome last year and having the end to the race that they had where it was turned on its head. The previous year, Tom Dumoulin being a very marketable winner, and the year before that, the way in which Nibali won the race in the final week, and Nibali riding the Giro as well, of course, this year. There seems to be a sort of a growing momentum behind the Giro, and you know, to not have either of Thomas or Froome, they might consider that to be a slight step back to have Bernal instead of one of those two, and so they might just pull out all the stops to try and get Geraint. I mean, I think the subtext of this is that Pinarello clearly would like Geraint Thomas to ride the Giro. They're obviously influential both with the Giro itself and with Team Sky. And my mention at the start of this discussion about, you know, the fact that for 10 years there's been total unity at Team Sky, total cohesion, both among the team, the riders, and also the partners. You know, this is the sort of thing that can happen when there's uncertainty. That there are little fissures, little fractures in relationships. And although this, I'm, you know, maybe exaggerating this, we don't know the extent of it. It's just one of those little things that, you know, one of these loose threads that you can pull away at, and the jumper, the pullover can unravel.
Yeah, absolutely. And you sort of think about season planning and you know, who wants to peak when and what other objectives they might have in the season. You know, there's also the prospect of a world championship road racing that's taking place in Yorkshire at the end of the year, which the course is not the hilliest. It's certainly nothing like last year in Innsbruck. But, you know, speaking to Mark Cavendish last week, he certainly thinks it's going to be a lot harder than people realise. It's very kind of grippy, there's a lot of twists and turns, not much flat road. The final kilometre itself is very difficult. There's a real sort of dead turn with about 300 metres to go, which, you know, could open it up to punchy, explosive riders. So, you know, who knows? That might come into a rider like Geraint Thomas's thinking. He seems to have turned his focus away from one-day races. He's not going to be riding the classics this year. And you know, you just don't know how a guy feels about having had one bite of that cherry, the Tour de France cherry. Is that, in, you know, for some guys that might be enough. It might be the achievement of a lifetime, and they're quite happy to go off and pursue other goals. For some others, it could be irresistible. The idea of going back and doing it again could be irresistible.
A man on a skateboard there, Daniel. A lot of skateboards around Palma. And of course, surprised not to find you on your skateboard here.
Yeah, I haven't got my skateboard today. Mark Cavendish was zipping around on a scooter last week. One of those, what do you call, what's the official name? Just a push scooter, just a, you know, you've got a small child, you should know. Yeah, a
scooter?
Yeah, you can hire them here with your mobile phone.
Not an electric one, quite a few electric.
It wasn't an electric one, it was an e-scooter.
Controversial.
Pinarello is a sponsor of the e-Giro. Maybe that's what Fausto Pinarello was referring to when he was talking about Geraint Thomas. Maybe Geraint Thomas is riding the e-Giro.
I mean, just finally on that, Geraint Thomas, his whatever he achieves this year, I think he just wants to start the Tour de France with the number one on his back, feeling like he's got a good shot at repeating what he did last year, and without maybe the Giro in his leg.
Here's one for you. Who was the last rider to wear the yellow jersey in a prologue of the Tour de France. Because the defending champion used to be allowed to wear the yellow jersey in the prologue of the following year's edition.
Was it 2003?
I think it was Bjarne Riis in... Was it not Bjarne Riis in 1997? Or was it... Or maybe you're right. Maybe it was later than this. And I looked this up. I should know this because I looked this up recently.
I don't know. I have a sort of vague recollection of Armstrong wearing the yellow jersey in the prologue in Paris in 2003, but I could be wrong. Answers on a postcard, please, to the Cycling Podcast in Watford, where your missive will be received by Lionel Burney, who's confined to his own quarters at the moment. Daniel, should we wrap things up for now?
Maybe we should, Rich. Maybe we should.
Okay, we'll be back next week with our third wheel. I'm sure Lionel will be back. Before we go, I should just tell you that the February edition of the Cycling Podcast Femina has just been released. That includes interviews with Lucinda Brand, who was second at the Cyclocross World Championships recently after a collision with her father in the pits. Katie Archibald talking about her plans for the season, and Danny Rowe, who's just retired, and a fascinating interview with her talking about her reasons for retiring. So that's Cycling Podcast Femina, that's out now.
Well, Rich, it definitely wasn't Bjarne Riis, because Jan Ulrich definitely wore yellow in the prologue in Dublin in 1998.
So it's sometime after then.
It was probably the controversial Lance Armstrong.
Well, there you go. That's all for this week. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
You've been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.